March Madness.
A little bit better, but not much.
It's my job to help make sure that House Republicans can coalesce and come together and draw consensus.
You should be very, very scared. Each and every one of you, very, very scared.
We are giving people more control and more of a say in the decisions that are made in their classrooms, at their businesses, on their lands. This is good progress, and we're going to make more in weeks to come.
Just beyond bizarre. What is beyond bizarre? Off the cliff. I don't know.
It's been very bad what's been happening to our country in terms of our companies and in terms of our jobs. So we're going to start turning it around. We're going to turn it around fast. It's not going to take a long time. It's going to go fast.
Happy April Fool's Day, everyone.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Well, it's been another strong week for the stock market this week. All the major indexes are up, and especially as we're seeing a big movement in the NASDAQ 100, we're also seeing small cap stocks rise. Is that indicating strength in the market? We'll be talking about that in hour one. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of the Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me in hour one will be Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research. He's seeing technology stocks and small caps leading the way with widespread participation within the S&P 500 sectors, which he says you always want to see that when you have a broad advance in all sectors participating. That's the old saying, a rising tide raises all ships. He's also seeing a very strong movement in the international. You're going to want to hear what he has to say about international stocks as well as the sectors. I asked him if there was any weakness. He'll tell us in hour one. Also joining me on the program is Dave Morgan from the Morgan Report as we talk about silver today. Silver is playing a catch-up bid to gold. Silver has been outperforming gold as a precious metal. And we're also going to talk about some of the drivers of silver. But Dave sees a topping out in the precious metals market. Warning for gold investors ahead. Chris Sheridan will be joining us in hour one to talk about those events that move the markets.
And I'm John Loeffler. You know, over the years, our technicians have been talking about the multiple phases of a bull market, three up phases to corrective phases. And we tend to believe we're in the final phase of this bull market. As a matter of fact, this month marks the eighth anniversary of the beginning of the bull market. So what does the final phase look like? And are there further gains ahead for investors, despite all of the promised rate hikes from the Federal Reserve? So we'll look at that. Then we're going to switch over to data and see what the data are telling us right now about the bull market and also about other things in the economy. Since November 8th, the Dow Jones is up 13%. We find the S&P and NASDAQ are up as well. So we're going to track the LEIs and see what they're actually telling us. It's almost like a crystal ball. And then something you might not think we would cover: over the last 7 years, we've seen a rise in global conflicts. And what is interesting is that our media in this country seem to be oblivious to major changes on the international scene, which will affect us from a security standpoint as well as from an investment standpoint. So we're calling it war and peace, and we'll look at the global situation, the radical changes that are occurring rapidly, and then what this means from an investment standpoint. All of that coming up today on The Big Picture as part of the Financial Sense News Hour. And as we always do, we take a look at what happened on Wall Street this week. Chris Sheridan is sitting in for Ryan Poplava. And let's see here, Chris. We didn't have a Fed meeting. No more rate hikes right on the immediate horizon. No major crises that I can think of in the market. So what did happen this week? What are the signposts?
Well, I think the big thing is that we wrapped up the first quarter this week. If we look at the performance year to date, we see the S&P 500 finished up a strong 5.5%, and that's the best Q1 performance that we've seen since 2013 in 4 years. The NASDAQ overshadows the S&P 500, though, being up 9.8% for the first quarter. When we look at what happened this week, markets stumbled early on in Monday morning with the follow-through that we saw from a lot of the disappointment from healthcare reform failing. We saw a bit of a stumble, but then we tested a major support level, which was the 50-day moving average on the S&P 500 and on the Dow. And then the markets basically bounced off of that point Monday morning and didn't look back. And I think now the focus is, of course, on tax reform, what we're going to see there, whether or not that's going to happen. When it comes to a direct stimulus to the markets and the economy, I think most economists and strategists were looking at tax reform.
Yeah, and Jim Poplav and I are going to be talking about a summary of that as we come up into the big picture, because the markets seem to be running on euphoria since the elections. However, the question is how much of the euphoria is actually going to come true.
Yeah, it's really interesting because one of the economic data points that we got this week was for consumer sentiment. The key takeaway from this report is there is really a sharp divide between where you stand. If you're a Republican or Democrat, if you're a Republican, then your sentiment levels, your confidence about, you know, the economy and the future outlook is very high. However, if you're a Democrat, the reports from that sentiment survey show that most Democrats expect an imminent recession, higher unemployment, lower income gains, and faster inflation. So, you know, basically all negative outcomes. So there's definitely a divide when we look at consumer sentiment among Republicans and Democrats. The Republicans are definitely much more on the euphoric side, of course. Democrats are much more pessimistic. And now it comes down to how many of these policies are we going to see come through, how quickly. But tax reform, that's something that I think a lot of Republicans clearly agree on. I think that is something that many say can be successfully passed. There's differing ideas on that. I'm reading reports on both sides of the aisle that they're setting up for a big fight. Others are saying that this should be something that will get passed fairly easily. So I think that's definitely going to be gaining a lot of the focus that we're going to be seeing in the weeks ahead.
It's going to be interesting as we move that one forward to see how much of it really materializes. And 80% of the country, I think, some close to 80, favors some kind of tax reform. Especially when you sit down, you know, if we had elections on April 20th every year, in other words, instead of in November, right after the income tax was paid, I think the outcome of elections would be radically different. Okay. Where people
feel
that's
a good point.
You know, it's not just the amount of money that people have to pay. It's the amount of pain you have to go through to fill out this blizzard of paperwork, you know, to file the income tax return. So that's what people are upset about. Anyway, Chris, what kind of interviews, since I have you here, are you going to be doing next week on FS Insider, the daily program we have?
We are going to be speaking to Neil Dutta at Renaissance Macro on his economic and market outlook. We're going to go into a lot of the economic trends, whether it's housing, consumer spending, the divergence between soft and hard data, and a number of other topics that we've been discussing regularly. We're also going to be speaking with someone from BlackRock, and it's largely going to be centering around Rick Rieders. He's a CIO at BlackRock. His recent presentation that he did just last week. So this is actually going to be a bit of a contrary view to Barry Bannister. If you listen to Barry Bannister's interview that we just did this week, Barry said that he thinks that when the Fed funds rate gets up to 1.75%, which is basically the ceiling he's looking at, that's at the point where we're going to start to see economic slowing take place with a market peak around 2018, and then a recession likely to take place in 2019. So that was his view. There was a lot that went into it, and we covered a lot of the big macro trends that he's watching that inform that view. But in any case, when we speak to this person at BlackRock, they're going to have a bit of a different view. And the idea is that there is more upside room to the Fed funds rate than what Barry Bannister believes. And so they're going to discuss why that is, what that means for financial markets, and how you should be invested. So that should be a really interesting interview from BlackRock's perspective. And lastly, we're also going to speak to someone on some current developments in artificial intelligence. This is going to be a little bit more of a outside the box interview discussing a recent article that was written that got a lot of traction. I think it's a really fascinating look at what we see in terms of technology. So that's going to be a really interesting interview that we're going to do next week as well.
All right, Chris, you're going to look forward to those. As a matter of fact, I always enjoy hearing them. So have a good weekend, and I appreciate you sitting in for Ryan Poplava, as I'm sure he does as well.
Thanks, John.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Those three methods, the CAPE ratio, Tobin's Q, and the household ownership of stocks as a percent of their financial assets, those three methods don't tell you anything about the short term. What they tell you a lot about is your long-term return potential. When stocks are overvalued on 10-year average earnings, CAPE. When they're overvalued on replacement book value, Tobin's Q. And when households have way overweighted stocks in their financial asset portfolios, that pretty much guarantees you're going to have really poor returns the next decade because they're overbought, overowned, overloved. And they're saying somewhere between a 3 and a 5. That's your total return annualized from 2017 to 2027 on New Year's Day.
Well, it's been another good week for investors, with the stock market averages logging on another gain after a brief correction. We have technology stocks leading the way and also smaller cap stocks. Joining us on the program is Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research. Dave, let's talk about this, I don't know what you would call it, a consolidation, a slight pullback, but it seems like things are up and away again this week. Tell us what you see in the market right now, especially as we're seeing this dominance of technology and also the recent movement of small cap stocks.
Yes, Jim. Thank you for having me on the show, first off. I think what we're seeing is we're really seeing the market in terms of its breadth is very bullish, and even many of the patterns within the staples sector and utilities, which historically are defensive, are exhibiting, you know, absolute bullish patterns. What you expect to see in a bull market, however, is that those growth areas of the market, such as technology and small caps, you want to see strong relative strength to reflect what investors believe the market's going to do. With both the technology and small caps leading the way, it does suggest that we are in a bull market. And again, healthy bull markets are defined with most sectors having some leadership capability within them. And again, I think that's why you're seeing at least positive charts within utilities and within the staples sector. Again, they're not outperforming on a relative strength basis, but it's nice to see that the breadth, at least they're helping to contribute to a positive breadth in the market.
Yeah, and if we take a look at performance year to date, we've seen strong performances in the small cap sector. We're also seeing biotech stocks do very well, and we're also seeing semiconductor stocks, but also we've seen gold stocks do well. Explain the difference.
Well, I think looking at the gold stocks, you know, they're not quite exhibiting, at least this year, leadership capability. I think that's, you know, belief that the market's going to continue on its growth trajectory, and we're not concerned about inflation. Typically, we'll start to see that at the end of the cycle, and we just don't see it currently. You know, small caps have taken kind of a backseat breather over the last several months. And, you know, just more recently here, we've seen, you know, a significant rally. But all in all, the small caps pulled back to a logical level of support. And we are seeing, at least over the last week or so, we're starting to see some positive inflections within the small cap. And I think part of that is what we've seen with the U.S. dollar, and the U.S. dollar has been unable to break out to a new high. And I think that along with that, we should have expected that large caps outperform. And now we're seeing at least a little weakness in the U.S. dollar with its inability to break out to new highs. And I think that's helping to contribute to the outperformance in the last week or so of the small caps.
When you see this kind of outperformance, and let's also talk about the advanced decline line, is that supporting this broad-based rally that you're seeing?
Absolutely. Yes, it is.
And when you see a stock market rally, and especially if you're in a bullish phase, what's the old saying, a rising tide lifts all boats? So you tend to see all sectors do very well, but you also want to see that advanced decline line telling you that, you know, a broad base of stocks are rising at the same time. Dave, when markets change or they correct, you see leadership changes. This leadership that we've seen since, let's say, this big rally began after the election, do you see that continuing forward, or do you see at some point in time that that could change?
I think it inevitably won't continue forever, but at some point, yeah, we would expect to see some negative inflections within the advanced decline line. We would expect to see some type of breakdown in technology. But again, I still think that's a far period off. I don't think that it's something that we're expecting in the next week or next month or next 6 months. And no one really knows exactly how many Fed rate hikes it will take to you know, extinguish this bull market, and that's historically what we would expect. But again, when we look back at history, you know, we were at very, very low rates, and I think that when you're that low, it's going to take a while to prop them up to get to a level at which we can really extinguish this bull market. And I think that's going to be done over time. And again, the time horizon until we see some tape action that depicts that, you know, investors can't handle any more rate hikes and it slows the market down or the economy enough. I think the jury's still out to determine what that date is.
As you approach, let's say, a peak in the business cycle and the peak in the, let's say, market cycle, the final phase, as technicians will call it, a lot of times you'll see things like energy really do well. Yeah, I think back to 2007 and 2008, but you also see a rotation into, let's say, consumer staples. So you have one part of the economy that is heated up with a little bit of inflation, and then you also see a rotation into consumer staples. Do you see anything like that occurring? And let's talk about energy, which has not done well. Is it bottomed, or do you think it has further to go?
A majority of the stocks that we're seeing within the energy sector have pulled back to the 200-day moving average. The energy stocks have underperformed for a little over a month. And, you know, I think that being that energy moved so significantly off the lows, I think that we have to see some backing and filling. I think part of what we're missing with looking at the energy sector overall is that, you know, most foreign markets were in the doldrums, and the U.S. for the most part decoupled from the rest of the world over the last several years. And what we're seeing in the foreign markets is they're starting to recouple. I think investors are going to stand back in a month or two and realize that, you know, you look at Hong Kong, you see it sitting on top side of a two-year base. You see many of the European markets are inflecting positively, and I think that's going to add up to, you know, it's going to take some more energy to grow the world, and most of the rest of the world are starting to recouple with the U.S. I do think that they will have a tendency to play catch-up, and the U.S. is ultimately the leader, or the general in this case. But again, I think that it's a positive sign to see the rest of the world recouple with the U.S.
Yeah, because you're seeing the EAFE and the MSCI Emerging Market Index is doing very well right now. So basically what you're saying is a lot of our markets are now in sync with each other, where before, previously, it was the U.S. market that seemed to be dominating global indexes.
That's correct. I mean, if you look around the world and, you know, conclude that the U.S. is within fractions of a historical high, and you look at Europe or Hong Kong or Australia, you're seeing that they're still far off. Brazil is still down significantly from its all-time high. But what we're seeing in the overall chart patterns is you're seeing a lot of ascending rallies and reactions, which would depict that there's still somewhat many markets around the world that are kind of in that bottom fishing or positive developing rather than in complete utter uptrends throughout history. And I think that they still have a long way to go.
The other thing that I wonder if you might comment on, when you normally see the Fed raise interest rates, what's the old rule, the three steps and a stumble rule? You see the markets run into a bit of a trouble. The Fed has now raised interest rates three times. But, you know, as I look at where interest rates are now, Dave, we're at a 1% Fed funds rate. I mean, that's basically where we were in 2004 when the Fed began raising interest rates. So do you think it's one reason why stocks have not had trouble with these rate hikes is we started with such a low level?
Exactly. It's the law of low numbers. And I think that right now we have to look at the market and realize that when the Fed raises for the next 25 basis points, in essence, we're going to see a 25% increase. You know, I can't think back throughout any period of time where you saw one rate hike that was a 25% increase. But again, it's from the law of low numbers. And I think that what it is encouraging is that 8 years of non-growth for the most part in terms of looking at the GDP, this is probably really starting to stir the pot in terms of businesses to say, you know, hey, we need to get ahead of this curve because we don't want to start expanding 6 months from now if we know rates are going to be higher. We need to do something now. And I think that's going to really turn up the volume in terms of what businesses are willing to spend. We've seen some absolutely terrific consumer confidence numbers. We've seen some business confidence numbers that we wouldn't have ever expected over the last 8 years come out recently. And I think that's a positive sign. And if it's positive for business, I do think that there's a trickle-down aspect that, you know, anyone that works at these companies is going to see an increase in business. I think they're going to feel much more comfortable about spending.
I want to talk about another index that has struggled as of late, and I wonder, get your thoughts if this is even valid anymore, and that's the Dow Theory. Typically, you know, when the Dow Industrials hits a new record, you want to see it confirmed by the transports, although one would argue that the Dow Industrial Average is less industrial today as the transportation. Is there any significance to the recent weakness in the transportation index, in your opinion?
I think more of anything, I think it was just discomfort about how fast it rose back in November. I think that's really why we saw the pullback in terms of relative performance. Again, the absolute patterns of these are still constructive. They're both above the 200-day. And as you alluded to on the Dow Industrials, you know, it's really, we've changed the makeup of that index substantially in terms of having industrial companies in there now. And I don't know that it's going to have the same weight it will, but, you know, as long as tech is doing well and you get some good patterns out of, you know, anything from an Apple to a Microsoft, you know, the Dow is going to do much better.
So when you see some of these stocks that are doing very well, like Alphabet, Amazon, and Apple, what is that telling you? Is that just really a reflection of the leadership that we're seeing in technology stocks right now?
Oh, absolutely. Tech is, you know, one of the best looking sectors right now. And I think that is alluding to the growth that we're going to see in the overall economy going forward. And I think it's going to continue to move higher, and it's probably going to be less affected by, I think, even rate hikes.
Yeah, one thing that we've seen in this bull market since it began in 2009 is we've seen the strength of the stock market driven by, let's say, stock buybacks, which have numbered close to $500 billion a year. Are you seeing in any of the work that you're doing that the individual investor is starting to come into this market, or are they still primarily invested in bond funds as they were, let's say, going back to 2009?
I think for majority of investors right now, I think there is a great degree of concern about bond funds, and it truly was in a bubble, and, you know, bubbles always take a long time to unwind, and it doesn't happen in a day or a week or a month. But overall, you know, I think a majority of investors do believe that rates are going to go up, and I think that we're going to continue to see fund flows go into the market. I think one of the biggest drivers in the equity market right now is you're seeing a lot of investors really move into the ETFs, and that's an area that is really competing against the active fund manager, and I think that's going to continue, but we're also competing on a global basis in terms of equity holdings, and you're seeing, again, a majority of the foreign markets look absolutely terrific, and I think it supports what we're seeing in the U.S., and in fact, like as I mentioned earlier, it's really a catch-up play in the European markets and Hong Kong, and I think we're going to be competing, again, for investors' dollars on a global basis now.
So if you had money that you had to put to work, given what you're seeing in the marketplace right now, what are the strongest areas, whether it's international or the strongest sectors? We talked about international is playing catch up. You talked about leadership and the technology. Is international and technology the place to be?
I do believe so. I do think that the U.S. is, again, is a great footing in terms of looking at, you know, technology. There's a number of sectors that we continue to be overweight, and that includes the financials, technology. I believe materials still warrants an overweight holding, and especially manufacturing here in the U.S. remains strong. But looking at least on an international basis, I would look to Europe as an area of strength that we're seeing, especially in the Stoxx 600. So you're seeing a lot of the small caps over there do much better as well. Germany is breaking out to a new high. India's, you know, breaking a topside of a base. Brazil is still sitting topside of a two-year base, and again, they're substantially below where they were 5 years ago. So I do think that there's just a number of places, and when you have a number of bullish areas in the market on a global basis, I think, again, that depicts what the breadth is, and I think it's just absolutely fantastic.
So if this trend continues, as we're talking about right now, where you have global markets seem to be in sync, you also have a pickup in economic growth, this continues forward, you have technology leading here. In other words, what would be some of the danger points you would be looking at if you were looking at the markets?
You know, I would be expecting that, you know, we'd have to have a rapid movement either within the bond market or the U.S. dollar market. The other things I would look for is look for toppy patterns within the leadership sectors, leadership stocks. That can be a number of technical patterns that we would see in it. That could be everything from a V reversal to a double top to a triple top or head and shoulders tops, which tend to be the most reliable. But, you know, I would also expect that relative strength would pick up in some of the defensive areas such as utilities and staples. And we are seeing some signs that in the near term, we're seeing, you know, some inflections on a positive basis within those sectors. But I think they're nothing more than tactical moves, and that is that the market got ahead of itself and needed to mark some time. And by marking time, just moving sideways is going to steer some investors into the safety areas or defensive areas of the market. So right now, I don't see any big flashing flags to suggest that something significant is going to happen. I think it's stay the route until we really get some signals that depict that this market is peaking out. I would expect that gold would surge as well. And again, if the U.S. dollar starts to move down, and, you know, we should see large caps actually outperform. And it doesn't mean that growth is over. It just, again, you're going to get these rotations between small cap and large cap and their exposure to foreign markets based on the U.S. currency.
Well, you know, Dave, every bull market that ended, at least in my career, was always ending with euphoria. I can think back of 2007 when everybody was going to get rich in real estate. Back in 1999 and 2000, we were all going to get rich with the new economy and technology. And you have this tremendous investor enthusiasm. I just haven't seen that in this market. Do you think we'll see it eventually?
Yeah, usually when we look at those periods in time, what you see in the market is you see a number of sectors underperform significantly, including areas of the market that we would consider growth at that time. For instance, when you looked at technology and came to conclude that, you know, technology was going to revolutionize the world, and in fact it did. Remember, no one wanted Amazon because all they'd sold was books, and now you can't get enough Amazon. But you're seeing that breath carry out through the sector, and now we realize that they really truly have a business model. Whereas back then, it didn't sound like a very good business model. So in periods like that where we get into, you know, major market tops, it's usually deteriorating breath and all of the fund flows are going into a particular sector or group. But even a group basis is probably not the correct wording for it, because really those bubble periods were defined, again, by narrowing breath and significant surges within a sector or group. I don't see that type of behavior right now. I do see that there's a number of areas in the market that continue to outperform. And there are a number of areas, such as consumer discretionary, that have significant underperformance. But even there, we're starting to see a few names start to pop up, like a Chipotle, which looks like it's bottoming. We're seeing a number of restaurants report some good numbers and breaking above multi-month, if not, you know, one-year basis. So I like to see that in a market, and especially it's nice to have the consumer on your side. And so far, the consumer, you know, has been on our side, unfortunately, has been in a very few names, such as an Amazon, for instance. So I think that, again, what we're seeing is the rising tide is coming in, and I think that we're going to see some good price patterns and good market moves within sectors. But the rotations, you know, have a tendency to be very fast and furious. That's okay. It's frustrating, I think, for many people, but at the same time, as long as we're not hitting descending rallies and reactions, I think that most of them will be marked with consolidations with moves higher.
So, Dave, if we were to have this conversation December 31st, if you were to take out your crystal ball based on what you're seeing in the charts, would you expect the stock market to be higher from where it is today?
Yes, I do.
Well, that's a pretty straightforward answer, and that's a great place to end. Dave, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work at Vermilion Research, you cover not only domestic markets and sectors, but you also do a considerable amount of research in the international area. How can they do so?
Our website is at vermilioncap.com, one L in Vermilion, or they can also call us at 952-922-7500.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com.
If you're approaching retirement age or concerned about making plans for those retired years and having adequate income, you're going to want to hear our Lifetime Income series every Monday and Tuesday here at financialsense.com. Right now, here's a preview of this week's Lifetime Income program.
Joining us on the program today is Stephen Siegel. He is with the Siegel Group. And Stephen, as we take a look at taxes today, one thing that at least strikes me, since 2010 and 2012, taxes have gotten more complex. We had a whole array of taxes that came into play affecting Medicare taxes, capital gains with Obamacare, and then in the 2012 tax bill, we had not only higher rates, but we also had losing some of those itemized deductions, the phase out of the personal exemption, and a bunch of other taxes. So as we begin, I wonder if you might explain for our listeners the difference between deductions above the line and below the line, because there's a big difference in terms of how that plays out for tax planning.
Well, thank you, Jim. The tax law certainly for individuals doing their income taxes has gotten significantly more complicated in the past few years. We used to be able to sit down at lunch with someone with a pen and a napkin and figure out their taxes. Now we need a computer and about five programs in about an hour. So it has gotten more complicated. The question you raised about above the line and below the line, deductions that are available to people to claim above the line means the distinction between gross income and adjusted gross income. Those are the better deductions, because if you get your adjusted gross income down, then you are in a better place.
Well, it started out to be a pretty good year for precious metals like we did last year. I guess the question is, will this continue with the Fed raising interest rates, and will the dollar strengthen again? Joining us on the program from the Morgan Report is Dave Morgan. Dave, I want to talk and begin our discussion with silver, because as I look at silver, it's been outperforming gold lately. You know, I want to get your take. What's behind that? Is it something that investors prefer it? Is it an undervalued asset that's playing catch up? Or is there something fundamental going on here that's driving that performance?
Well, Jim, there's a few things to discuss. One, if we go back to not the last interview that you did with me, but I think the previous one, it was early 2016. And at that time, silver was underperforming gold, and the ratio was rather high. And that had me concerned. And on the show, we talked about, and I specifically mentioned, that unless silver caught a bid and moved higher and started to narrow the ratio, I was inclined to think that the rally might sputter out. Probably within just a few trading days of that interview, silver started to perform quite well and started to significantly outperform gold. And at that time, I knew that the rally was going to continue. And I also knew that it would probably go longer than I had initially anticipated in early January, which the seasonality has worked actually quite well for a few years in a row. That rally took us all the way into the summer, which is unusual because normally, especially if you talk to someone like Frank Holmes, who's done the research as well, August is usually the best time to buy gold equities because it's usually the low for the year. Last year, 2016, wasn't the case. Another thing to point out is that the sector at large, the miners, were the best performer as a group, as outlined by IBD, Investors Business Daily, year over year, which means that not only the rally that took place from January into the summer, but also fell back into the end of the year, that year over year basis, it still was the best asset class from a equity perspective. Jim, I think there's a couple things. One, silver is a smaller market. It is one that is more volatile than gold because of that fact. So whenever you see, you know, a nice move in gold, you usually see a greater move in silver to the upside. And it's also true to the downside. Also, from my friends that are in the retail and wholesale silver market, I think the market is satisfied, quote unquote, which means that most of the gold and particularly silver bulls and bugs basically have enough. In other words, there aren't new participants in this market. And for any market to move higher, you need, you know, participation, whether it be people that are already in the market that want to buy more or new buyers because the people that are in the market have spent what they want to spend on that asset class. So I think that's fundamentally key. I use the silver gold ratio as one of my key indicators. There's really three or four that I look at to tell me, not me tell the market, but the market to tell me that a rally is going to begin or it's going to continue or it's stronger than I might have anticipated.
Now, we've seen this in the past, Dave. Going back, there are two things. Last year, it was characterized that the stocks outperformed the bullion. This year, the stocks have underperformed the bullion. And then also recently, we're seeing that ratio of silver outperformance to gold. Now, we've seen that happen, Dave, 5 or 6 times over the last 12 months. And one thing that makes silver, I guess, a little bit different than gold, it's also impacted by what's going on in the economy, because silver is an industrial metal. It's used in so many applications today. Do you think part of that has had to do with, let's say, its economic implications rather than its monetary implications?
Partly so. And the reason I say that with a bit of authority, Jim, is that if you look at Mitsubishi, or maybe it's Samsung, I'm sorry, but one of the major industrial users of silver has a direct offtake agreement with Avino Mines. Now, Avino is one that I own, so I'll disclose that. Secondly, it's one of my favorite in our small caps. But why would a company of that clout go directly to a mine? Well, I think because they're thinking ahead. I don't want to overstate the case, but one fact remains that silver is an absolute essential metal for high technology applications. Anything electrical or electronic requires silver, and there are substitutes. I mean, you could substitute gold, platinum, palladium, but it's uneconomic to do so. So silver does have more and more applications than any other metal available. And the only thing that actually has more uses as a commodity than silver does is oil. So there is pressure there. And there's always interesting things that come out of the Silver Institute on their research as far as what these applications are and what the potentials could be. If we go back a decade or so, Jim, and we look at using silver as a wood preservative and also using it to get rid of the arsenic that was used in children's playground equipment. The implications of that were phenomenal. I mean, it was something like 100 million ounces on an annual basis. It never took place because of the economics and also the amount of silver required. I think it was more not economically driven as far as what the cost would be or the health issues, which were significant. It was based on the fact that how are you going to grab that much silver on an annual basis? You're not. Solar has been very, very strong, but not as strong as initially projected. Jessica Cross from VIA Metals did a very good study in the early 2010. And I based some of my work on the next decade in silver on her work and gave her credit for it, of course. And she was looking at silver to be about 140 million ounces on an annual basis offtake for solar panels by this time, by 2017. We're at about half that. Actually, her projections were very, very accurate. What she didn't anticipate was the economics, which means that people that manufacture these panels are going to squeeze the margins as much as possible, which means you're going to use the least amount of silver per panel that you possibly can to get the required performance. And that's what's happened. If you look at it and study it, you're going to find that over the last decade or so, less and less silver is used on photovoltaics. I think that trend is kind of stalled for now. Could it continue? Yes, but you can only get, you know, so much out of, you know, per ounce of silver. Having said that, national governments such as India are still, and China, both are banging the drum to do more and more solar. So there is an industrial demand that is strong enough, Jim, to make a difference at this point in time.
Dave, let's talk about the application of silver in a lot of technology, because one of the main drivers in the past and uses of silver was photography. But now we have our cell phones, we have digital photography. And in addition to being a demand, it was also a source of supply. So a lot of scrap silver, which came from photography, was also a source of supply. That is less and less the case today. So I guess one question is technology use of silver strong enough to replace what was once used in photography, number one? And number two, if you're not getting scrap silver from photography like you used to, what about the diminishing supply of scrap silver in terms of source of supply?
A great question, and one that I wouldn't say I struggled with, but certainly took a little bit of study. First of all, you go back to my first book, which is Get the Skinny on Silver Investing. I devote a whole chapter or two on the zero-sum game involving photography. I mean, basically, for all practical purposes, all the silver used in photography came out in solution when the film was processed and went back on the market. And of course, that has diminished significantly, as you stated, Jim. So once it stopped, and it hasn't stopped completely, but for talking purposes, let's say it stopped. So now you had this big supply that was in solution that would be taken out and could be, you know, put into the market. And it was. The big factor that I was quiet about but wasn't believing too much was when Jeff Christian and I, and of course I, you know, pretty friendly with Jeff. We don't agree on our worldview, but that's immaterial to this discussion. I was told by Jeff that we would see enough electronic waste to pretty much make up for the difference in what you'd see in photography. And I thought, I'm not so sure. The facts are, and I look at more than the CPM study, I also look at the Silver Institute study, there has been a very large increase in the amount of silver recycling because there are so many products that use silver today. Example, cell phones or smartphones in particular use both gold and silver. And so that aspect of the market has actually been, you could think of it as it has taken over the recycling function that photography used to have. And there's an add-on, Jim. And the add-on on the photography side is one that, you know, unless you're as involved as I am, because I'm not obsessed about silver, but it's my job to look at it deeply, that the old metric of using X-ray film, well, this was silver on plastic, and there were literally thousands upon thousands upon thousands of these pieces of plastic that were stored for medical purposes that are no longer needed. They're being digitized and have for quite some time. And so there's sort of a backlog of recycled silver sitting in this plastic. And what's interesting is that the amount of silver that they recover from this is rather significant. And I didn't know this until a few years ago. They also recover the plastic. So when those X-ray films, if you will, are taken to the recycler, they're brought back to basics. You get silver on one side and you get plastic on the other, and they're both reused.
Let me talk about another source of supply that we saw come online in the last decade. As the price of silver, Dave, rose from $3 to $4 range, got all the way up to close to $50, we saw the advent of pure silver producing companies, and we saw a plethora of those companies, many of them turning into producing companies. What has happened to these pure silver companies? I mean, how many have survived? I think at one time I talked to you during the downturn, some of these companies, I think you mentioned, it turned to growing marijuana. So, I mean, what about pure silver companies as a source of supply for silver? How many of them are around today, and are they of any significance when it comes to supply?
No, I mean, there's very few remaining. A lot of these smaller companies that had a great story turned out to be not such a great story. And there aren't really that many at all. At one time, Jeff, myself, and others were going to try to consolidate the recycling business into one entity and take, let's say, the lion's share, because a lot of these operations are kind of mom and pop. And it failed. It was, I think it was a good idea, because a lot of these people that are own these type of businesses, they don't have anyone that really take them over. But anyway, that didn't take place. But as far as a pure silver play, there really aren't that many. As far as on the mining side, there were very few that were pure silver. And of course, a silver mine is defined by the fact that the bottom line of the corporation has more coming into it cash flow wise through silver than any other asset. But almost all quote unquote silver mines are silver lead zinc mines, silver zinc mines, silver copper mines, silver gold mines. There's another asset with them. This is, you know, an area we probably should discuss more of kind of what's happened in the mining industry.
Yeah, I want to go to that, because one of the things that I noticed last year when the gold market took off, it was really the stocks that led and outperformed. Recently, with the rise of gold that we saw, the stocks were underperforming the metals. And one of the things that I've seen in many of these mining companies, Dave, that were reporting earnings, their earnings were terrible. And the miners did what they typically did in the last decade, just before gold peaked, is they raised more money. They over-diluted shareholders. It seems to be a perpetual habit with the guys that run these companies. They're poorly run. They're not run from a shareholder point of view. So as you look at the, let's say, the precious metals stocks, what's your view? Because I tell you, I see one disappointment after another, unless you're looking at a royalty company.
Well, as a shameless plug for your listeners, I mean, we caught on to, you know, what was going on in the industry fairly early on, which means that there were a lot of competitions to the mining industry that didn't take place in the last bull market. Specifically, you had a lot of ETFs where a hedge fund could hedge by buying an ETF instead of having to take a chance on a top tier mining company. So this really diluted a lot of the professional money that would have normally come into the mining industry. Also, the advent of the royalty model, which was few and far between going back, you know, 20, 30 years. I mean, you had Franco-Nevada, one of my favorites. I still own it, and I've owned it for years, and it just keeps chugging up and up. And of course, it goes down from time to time. But that's one that's on the top tier list, been there forever, and continues to, you know, outperform. So the shameless plug is that we have stressed the royalty companies in the Morgan Report's portfolio, because a royalty company really doesn't care very much about what the costs are to the producer, because the mandate is between the producing company and the financier, which is the royalty company. There are problems from time to time, but if you're diversified, those are overcome. Back to the miners specifically, Jim, what I'm about to say may upset some listeners, because I know that there are, let's say, specific biases in the gold bug and silver bug community. But, you know, I'm objective and I try to tell it like it is and be objective. One of the earlier conferences that I went to when I was getting broken into the speaking circuit was with the Silver Institute. And this was in the early 2000s. And the Institute had invited a speaker that represented the Rothschild banking interests in the mining sector. And you can look it up. It's publicly disclosed. But he was speaking specifically of the, you know, the RTZs, the Rio Tintos, the BHPs, Broken Hill, BHP, Anglo Ashanti, these large conglomerate mining companies. And what he said, what you have indicated, he basically stated he hoped that the mining cycle would not repeat what it has always done in the past, which means that they would overproduce and basically shoot themselves in the foot. They would get this big run up and there'd be a brief period of time where you'd have to basically sell your shares at a profit, because now that there was, quote unquote, a glut or an oversupply, or they had spent too much money to increase their production and not thought it through carefully, that this, what he called a commodity cycle, would be repeated. Well, unfortunately, Jim, that is exactly what has taken place again. So a lot of companies, and the better run ones, have done a good job at bringing their margins down, getting more efficient in their mining operations, cutting costs wherever possible, and on it goes. But it seems as if this commodity cycle, and it's not just the precious metals miners, you can look at it for lead, zinc, copper, any of the base metals. It is a, something that just doesn't seem to be into the management consciousness of how are they going to manage correctly. And a lot of times, as you know, and I'd like to throw it back to you, Jim, about, you know, what happens to the share structure. A lot of times these companies self-finance through the dilution process. So maybe you'd like to talk about that.
Well, I mean, it's just, you know, we always look at industries, and it is one of the most inept industries I've ever seen. You know, one of the things that I compare it to is the energy industry. And when stocks are cheap and you've had a downturn, you'll see companies buy other companies, you know, and Exxon buy Mobil. And when the mining companies do this, they always do this at the peak. And when they do it, they over-dilute. They pay exorbitant prices for it, and they don't look at shareholder value. Very, very few companies I have found, it's just like the Rothschild comment at that conference you went to, you know, what you have to do when you look at these companies, they almost have to become momentum plays. When the price of metals are moving and you see the price of the shares moving at the same time, at some point you take your profits, because these aren't what I call Warren Buffett stocks. They're not the kind of companies you can sit there, because they're commodities, and sit and hold them for the long term. You almost have to trade them. Dave, a final question, if I may. As you take a look at this sector, you know, one of the things that you always want to see confirmation when the metals move. You want to see silver confirm gold and the mining stocks confirm the price of the metal. I just don't see that right now.
No, Jim, I absolutely agree. And as you know, our website members pay a fee and they get our best thinking. And I am agreeing with you. I think that we're topping out and double topping, if you want to use it in the technical parlance, about 1250 gold. And there's all kinds of the rah-rah, sis-boom-bah channels out there. And it seems that there's a lot of quote-unquote analysts out there in the gold and silver space prior to, let's say, 10 years ago, when it was myself and a few others. Regardless, we do our own work. We are independent. And unfortunately, it doesn't look real bright for my analytical work that we're going to see much in the way of a robust metals price for the near term. Longer term, fundamentals have really never been better. In most cases, people don't need to subscribe to the Morgan Report unless they really want leverage and they want to know the best royalty companies. And I guess, Jim, I wouldn't say argue with you, but I wanted to point out that you're right about mining companies in general. They're dating stocks, not ones that you marry. That isn't necessarily true, though, in the royalty companies. I mean, if you look at what Franco-Nevada did before it was bought out by Newmont, and then it was spun out from Newmont back to Franco-Nevada, I mean, that's one that you can hold. And these are the type of companies that, you know, we stress in our work, because we're here to make money. We're not here to fool around. So I agree. I do not like what I'm seeing in the fundamentals coupled with the technicals right now. I think by the end of the year, it'll be brighter. It is not a repeat of last year, which many on the internet said, 2017 is going to be just like 2016, which implied that you could buy in January and hold all the way through the middle of the summer or in the late summer and sell at a big profit. I do want to advocate that I do trade these markets. I think, I know there's a lot of people that have a bias against doing so. I've been doing this for a long time. I never trade my core, but it was really nice last year to get that January bottom and get out the top in the summertime. And even my own people that, got the call, some of them said, well, it's not going to pull back that much. Thank you. I'm a buy and hold investor. And I'm not trying to tell anyone what to do. I'm just telling the type of work and insights that we provide.
So, Dave, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow your work at the Morgan Report, how could they do so?
Jim, the best thing is get on our free email list. Just go to themorganreport.com, give us a first name and a primary email address, and you can get on a free letter, which will give you some insights in what we do at the for the website members.
Now, if I do say so, we have some interesting things coming up on the Big Picture as the next part of the Financial Sense News Hour. We've talked about the various phases of a bull market, generally three up phases, two corrective phases, and then three stages. So if we assume that we're in the final phase of this bull market, what will it look like? And are there any further gains ahead for investors? Now, coupled with that, we'll take a look at the leading economic indicators and see what they're indicating, the real numbers versus the euphoric numbers, I guess we'll say, because the market's been in euphoria since the elections in November. And finally, a section you might not have thought about, we'll call it War and Peace. There's a rise in global conflicts, but radical changes on the geopolitical scenes, especially in the area of military armament, and our media seem oblivious to it. What does that mean in terms of investment and security? All of that coming up next on The Big Picture as the Financial Sense News Hour continues at financialsense.com.